Right, good evening, everybody. I'm Simon Bendinning. I'm the head of the European Institute and I'm the professor of European philosophy there. I'm really, really excited about the event tonight. Thank you all for coming. We'll have, after a brief introduction from me, our speaker will speak for about 20 minutes without special interruption, and then I'll have some discussion with him myself, and then we'll open it up for some further discussion with you as well. One of the things that was struck me when I was reading the book last week was Johnny's quite keen to remind us of his own position with respect to what, as it were big mainstream writings about black experience in Europe or in Britain or anywhere else, which tend to emerge from universities, at the academic writings and academic scholars studying as sociologists or anthropologists or political scientists, the life experience and existence of black people in their communities, wherever they are. One of the things that Johnny begins with is to just let you know that the travels that he's undertaking, he says, weren't funded or reviewed by an academy. It is, he says, a document produced largely independently of any official organization, bodies, or academic institutions. And there's a certain distance from academia that the book maintains throughout, not in a kind of turning up its nose at what academics have done, but wanting to think whether there's a sort of concrete experience of life, of a black existence in Europe that's kind of eclipsed in some ways by academic writings. And he does refer to people writing in academia, particularly Carol Phillips. There's quite a long section, and Du Bois, and Paul Gilroy, and others. And they're obviously important for you, but nevertheless, it seemed to me also important for you to let us know that this isn't just an academic book. You imagine at one point two books of a very academic kind, which might be thought as a sort of caricatures of what you're not doing. One of them's called The African Situation. It's a great title of a book, probably written in the 19th century or 18th century, but you could still imagine, probably, I don't know, if we Google it, there's probably one from last week as well, The African Situation. And then the other one was called A Concise History of Europe. That other book, which there is one just out by Simon Jenkins, and in fact we had him here a few weeks ago talking about it. It's called a Short History of Europe, a very short history of Europe. But that too, as it were, is not what you're offering us. So you have these two, The African Situation and The Short History of Europe, Concise History of Europe, and the thing is that you're not in either of those, right? Those books, Johnny Pitts is not in them, and Johnny Pitts' experience is not in them. So this is, first of all, this book is in a way your story. It's not a general, I will come to talk about this, it's not like a generalization of your experience in any way, but it's, as it were, your story. And really, for the European Institute here, where we're all academics studying Europe, we're delighted to have you with us tonight to introduce us to an idea that will be new to many people here of the Afropean. And we can welcome him now, Johnny Pitts.
Showing some of my photographs. Can you see them? Is it dark enough? I guess not. Is there any way to dim the lighting?
I don't know. Bill, have a go.
Thank you, Simon, for welcoming me here. I'm really, really happy to be here and a little bit daunted. It's actually as an autodidact, it's actually...
That's too much. You won't be able to see his text.
Yeah, yeah, that's good. That's all right. Yeah, it's people like you and Mark Fisher, actually, who helped me get to grips with Derrida. And and I'm particularly interested in Mark Fisher's reading of Derrida's ontology, you know, the hauntology. Yeah, but in French, ontology. I feel like what moved a lot of the, what moved me through this book was being sort of haunted by a failure of a future in a certain way, by the fall of communism. Not that I'm romantic about communism, but that the fall of an alternative balance to capitalism. I feel like I came of age when Paul Gilroy once told me that it was my generation. There was a war on the imagination of my generation. It seemed like anything that didn't sort of talk about what was good for business didn't make sense. I remember him saying that he went over to teach in America, and when he came back, all his leftist friends had by the time New Labour had got into power, had become management consultants. And I think I see myself almost like as a member of the New Labour generation. I felt that when Tony Blair got into power as a kid, that Britain had come to terms with its multiculturalism, and I felt like it was missold a little bit. I feel like, as somebody who's working class and grew up in a multicultural area of Sheffield, my area was very multicultural, but the borough that it's in, you know, 81% of the people who live in the borough voted to leave the European Union, and actually I found that there was a disjuncture between the notion of multiculturalism and what it means to be working class. I'm thinking about works by people like Marc Augier and even Pico Iyer, who wrote a book called Global Soul, where it was like you could be multicultural if you could afford to be multicultural, if you went to international school, or if you could operate in these sort of international spaces. And suddenly there was a sort of divide on the street level, on a working class level, between what the real living, breathing multiculturalism for everybody and working class culture. And so for me, I'm trying to find a way to, I guess, put together a kind of multiculturalism 2.0, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that's what I'm trying to achieve with this book in a certain way, and that's why there's a sort of, I guess, a distance from I don't want to say spaces of elitism, like, but a distance from the academy, maybe, even though like all my work is powered by academics, you know. But I wanted to distance myself because I wanted to find a way to get knowledge and tell a story that was just uneven and complicated, and not that it's not complicated in academia, but that was told by ordinary people, you know, an everydayness. Anyway, I'll go into my talk. Sorry, I went on a little bit there. And like Derrida, actually, I love a good portmanteau. When I first heard it, it encouraged me to think of myself as whole and unhyphenated, Afropean. Here was a space where blackness was taking part in Europe, in shaping European identity at large. It suggested the possibility of living in and with more than one idea. Africa and Europe, or by extension, the global South and the West, without being mixed this, half that, or black other. That being black in Europe didn't necessarily mean being an immigrant. I'm reading partly from the introduction, by the way, of my book, but I'll be expanding parts of that introduction and showing some photographs, some of which are in the book and some aren't. Labels are invariably problematic, often provocative, but at their best they can sing something into visibility. And from my stimmied vantage point, growing up in a working class area of Sheffield, ravaged somewhat by the external forces of free market economics and the internal protective force of local insularity that took shape in post-Cold Wars, I began to notice a world that had been invisible to me before, or at the very least implausible. In my small corner of Britain, I'd felt I was being forced to react against one culture or over-identify with the other. Originally coined in the early 90s by David Byrne and Belgian Congolese artist Marie Dawn, frontwoman of music group Zap Mama, I first encountered this notion of Afropean in the realms of music and fashion. Among many others, Le Nubians, soul sisters from Chad by way of France, exuded it, as did Nena Cherry, whose roots are Swedish and Sierra Leonean. Joy Denolani from South Africa via Germany, and Claude Grunitzky's Trace publication. Transcultural Styles and Ideas was the magazine's tagline and reflected Grunitzky's own Afropean identity. He had a Polish grandfather on his mother's side, was born in Togo, raised in Paris, and launched his magazine in London. This was a very attractive scene that I was tapping into. Beautiful, talented, successful black Europeans, effortlessly articulating their cultural influences in coherent and creative ways. It was particularly attractive to me because the sense was that this iteration of blackness existing in Europe appeared as if it wasn't going to be going anywhere anytime soon, felt closer to home than the sometimes overbearing African-American art forms and more encompassed and nuanced than the Black Britain Club, whose sense of itself was starting to feel outdated, often packaged exclusively as an embodiment of the Windrush generation. In the last national census, for the first time, more black Brits self-identified as black African rather than Afro-Caribbean. Initially then, I saw Afropean as something of a utopian alternative to the doom and gloom that has surrounded the black image in Europe in recent years and an optimistic route forward. I wanted to work on a project that connected and presented Afro-Europeans as lead actors in our own story. And with all this glorious Afropean imagery in mind, I imagine this would result in some kind of coffee table photo book with snippets of feel-good text to accompany a series of trendy photographic portraits. There would be images of the success stories of black Europe, young men and women whose street style effortlessly and elegantly articulated an empowered black European mood. It was a visit to the so-called jungle in Calais in 2016 that encouraged me to reconsider this approach. Over some fragrant milky Arabic tea, Hisham, a young man from Sudan who ran one of many small, remarkably organised cafes and had been living in the jungle for 10 months, told me how he'd lost everything, had no surviving family members, had painful memories of the past and tremulous visions of the future and was stuck in this limbo land between Africa and Europe, home, a little of which he'd miraculously fashioned in his cushion-covered cafe in anonymity. As I left his creaking plywood premises, he suggested that I write about his story and about life in the jungle, a request that I was nervous about. This man was intelligent, articulate and literate. Wouldn't it be better that he write about the jungle himself? Maybe I could help attract attention to his writing or publish his story on the website that I run. But what did I personally know about seeing friends massacred, fleeing war, hiding for my life in shipping containers or on ill-equipped boats in order to arrive penniless at a bunch of cold, windswept shacks in the hinterlands of northern France, apart from what he was telling me? After exchanging contact details, I left the jungle on my bicycle and slowly realised that I was being watched and followed through the blustery streets of Calais by the French military police, the gendarmerie. Attempting to enter the white gates of the port to catch my ferry back to the UK, I was stopped before I could even get to passport control, searched, asked for my ID, where I was going, where I'd come from, how long I'd been away and why. And then finally, after more questioning and looks of suspicion, I was allowed to enter an official compound I'd seen other brown-skinned men of my age look longingly at from a distance. I was in and they were out. Unlike the people I met in the jungle, I wasn't so much living in limbo as living with liminality. I was in because I had ID. I had ID because I was born and raised in Britain, had a history connected to Europe, knew how things ran. And yet within this piece of geography, this idea of Europe, I was frequently reminded that I wasn't all the way in. On Remembrance Day, a day I've come to dread for the way it spikes, an ugly nationalism, which I sometimes find myself on the receiving end of, I was hit with that old chestnut and told to go back to where I came from by a middle-aged man, red-faced with rage and racism. My skin colour disguised various facts, such as my grandfather having fought for Britain behind enemy lines in the Second World War and winning a medal for doing so. My skin had disguised my Europeanness. European was still being used as a synonym for white. If Afro-European was something that could attempt to address this issue, I needed to find out what lay behind or beyond its brand, a brand largely black-spun and authored. But that's all this was for now, a pleasant idea that was being sold to me and involved PR companies, stylists, fashion photographers and art direction. In Britain, it was this vision of corporate multiculturalism, this veneer of inclusion that Tony Blair's New Labour had used in an attempt to make Britain appear international, open-minded, forward-thinking and ready for business in the global economy, without really affecting policies for long-term change in the way Britain treated its immigrants. Did Afro-European only include beautiful, economically successful and often light-skinned black people? Afro-European as aspiration was one thing, but as I was writing about an interplay between black and European cultures, I realised this utopian vision of a black European experience would mean willfully ignoring realities shared by a majority of black people living in Europe. It would mean making the numerous groups of unemployed black men I saw at train stations, or the African women cleaning toilets, or the disenfranchised communities struggling in the hinterlands of cities completely invisible. It also seemed disingenuous to leave out my own culturally rich, if also less glamorous, experience of growing up mixed race in Britain and how it felt to travel Europe as somebody who identifies as black. It became apparent that I should let the reader know where I was coming from in order that they might better understand where I was heading to. That is, the underdocumented areas of Europe that often contradict the homogenised monoculture depictions suggested by tourist boards and pocket-sized travel guides. In 1948, the same year he was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, T.S. Eliot famously penned his influential work, A Non-Fiction, Notes Towards the Definition of Culture, in which he wrote, "What is culture? Culture may be described simply as that which makes life worth living, and it's what justifies other peoples and other generations in saying, when they contemplate the remains and the influence of an extinct civilization, that it was worthwhile for that civilization to have existed." Eliot encompassed a view that much of Britain and Europe believed to be true at that time, that culture was colonial, conjured at the imagined top of society, which is to say by aristocracy, and that it was the duty of the noble duty of the upper classes to extol and disseminate the virtues of culture to the masses, that the spread of culture wasn't a two-way process but only top-down. And yet T.S. Eliot's own definition of culture, that culture is something that makes life worth living, is evidence of a worthwhile people, didn't come from the so-called top for me. The landscape that sustained my childhood as someone born black, northern and working class in Margaret Thatcher's Britain was constructed by what I've come to describe as the B-side. In 90s British urban music culture, and urban here I'm not using it in a reductive way, I'm using it as an accurate term actually, urban music. Very often underground heads would buy 12-inch LPs for the unofficial remixes or dubs offered on the B-side of a release rather than their official radio-friendly A-side. And this notion of the unofficial, unpromoted, but often more interesting alternative to the official is something that can be applied to the geography that surrounded the music. High-rise estates, where I grew up at least, doubled as pirate radio stations and concrete canvases for graffiti artists. Barbershops sold bootleg mixtapes. Terrace houses doubled as blues party venues. Hinterland topographies hosted illegal street parties. These were the spaces that contained the pulse of black life in Sheffield, the city where I was born and raised. It was where you could find the type of multiculturalism that was antithetical to the pretty corporate, commodified multiculti of New Labour. Organic, clandestine meeting spaces for those of us living on the B side of Britain with little chance of ever being documented properly. By the time I'd turned 25, there were no remains for me to contemplate. The civilisation I'd taken part in already seemed extinct because the landscape of my childhood had already vanished. My first youth club housed in Kelvin Estate, which is a big brutalist estate. It's a bit like the famous Parkhill, which has now been turned into sort of the largest listed building in Europe, sister estate. The first club I'd ever danced in, my first place of work, the building that housed my lifelong barbers, the market where I had some of my earliest memories of my grandma, the street that used to house a local unofficial street carnival, and the building that housed the Shebeen where my mother and father met, it had all been vanquished with scant evidence that it ever existed. I began to realise that unless something truly catastrophic happens, my great-great-great-grandkids will be able to stand on Waterloo Bridge and look at the same St Paul's Cathedral or Houses of Parliament as I can now. Landscapes can hold narratives, suggest identities, preserve cultures. Some cultural landscapes are better preserved than others. But the things attached to the culture that gave birth to and sustained me made my life worth living in an otherwise fairly depressing situation, are constantly in danger of being lost. In a 2014 conversation with Paul Gilroy at the University of Cambridge in a slightly different context, Professor Cornel West mentions that empowered black traditions are fragile things with a long history actually of being crushed, and how black communities have long had to find creative and sometimes clandestine ways to preserve memories and legacies that often tend to die with each generation. The physical and metaphysical, or rather literal and figurative foundations swept away and then have to be rebuilt from scratch by each generation. If my own psychic landscape was disappearing, I began to wonder about other histories, both working class and black, and how I might be able to unearth them. I had a natural mistrust of formal education, and I was guided by seminal texts by Paul Gilroy, Stuart Hall, Said, and Francois Maspero, Du Bois. I wanted to find a way to arrive at black Europe from the street up. Knowledge and history from equally ephemeral landscapes and local knowledges. And it was through Afropean that I found a kind of portal. And so I decided to become that rarest of creatures, the black backpacker. I was looking for landscapes and I found locals. I'd be travelling during a time when a multicultural backlash suggesting the likes of me represented some sort of failed temporary experiment was sweeping across the continent, and felt it was time to regroup and reassert my own plurality as part of a larger mission to suggest how multiculturalism might work beyond the pages of a reactionary press and the very real multiculturalism embedded in my own heritage and in the streets of European cities. Afropean had to be more than, to paraphrase Labour MP John Crudders, an obsession with an authentic search for self, and something more like a contribution to a community with its trade-offs and compromises. It had to build a bridge over that dividing sense that says whether you're in or out and form some sort of informal cultural coalition. And in many ways, I had no choice but to let a subjective light slip between the cracks and remind myself that I wasn't trying to insert this word that resonated with my experience, Afropean, as some sort of authorised new discourse in racial politics. It seemed to me that many big picture books about race were being produced at a time when day-to-day dialogue and conversation were breaking down, when interactions in real life and on social media lacked goodwill and humour, with authors and bloggers presenting themselves as infallible spokespeople. This work is an attempt. I often feel like within the black community, something that worries me is that people mistake rudeness for revolution, but we'll get onto that later. This work is an attempt to use on-the-ground travel reportage as a way to wriggle free. And that was for the black people in the audience, by the way. I wasn't talking over you to the white people saying black people are rude. That was for the black people in the audience. This work is an attempt to use on-the-ground travel reportage as a way to wriggle free from the pressures of theory and honestly reveal the secret pleasures and prejudices of others as well as myself, by which I mean the human self. Learning to be comfortable with being black and imperfect in depictions on a page, an effort to begin with the personal in order to arrive at the universal. So while there are encounters with movers and shakers, artists, thinkers, fashionistas, intellectuals, writers and academics, many of the stories I found are about as far away as you can get from that coffee table sheen, those of addicts, homeless people, thieves, drug dealers and militants. But there's something else too. Hip-hop artist Mos Def once wrote of the depiction of black culture in the media that we're either niggers or kings, we're either bitches or queens. And in contemporary Europe, it seemed to me that black people were either presented as uber-stylized retro hipster dandies in thick-rimmed glasses and a bit of kente cloth, or dangerous hooded ghetto youth. In the middle of these high and low superlatives of blackness is perhaps the most important inclusion in this book, chance meetings with regular folk, casual encounters with shop workers, hawkers, tour operators, students, bouncers, activists, musicians, youth workers, and those I simply made friends with in cafes, bars, community clubs and hostels, who all unveiled the experience of the everyday set slightly aside from a grand narrative, beauty and black banality. As my travels weren't funded or reviewed by an academy, and for the most part I didn't and couldn't swan around Europe's swankier hotels, Carol Phillips is my mentor, and without him this work wouldn't have been possible. But in all his books, all his meetings take place in beautiful hotels. I booked him in his sub for it, sorry. So this style of working also suited practical considerations. The book is forged by independent black budget travel. It's an independent black working class journey. The view I was left with then was something of a sullied utopia, a place of struggle and hope, of high drama and quiet nuance, of conclusions and ambiguity, connections and disjuncture, but always there were humour and humanity in my encounters and interactions. To paraphrase Robert Frost, my quarrel with the continent is a lover's quarrel. I've travelled extensively across the planet, including West Africa, where my blackness is rooted, and Brooklyn, that hotbed of black culture that has infinitely inspired me and where my father was born. And still nowhere else feels quite as much like home as Europe. I was taught how to read and write here. Not always the right things, necessarily, but I speak its languages, engage in some of its customs, and make use of the intricate and sometimes faded beauty of its old architecture, the museums and galleries, sometimes in existence thanks to the blood and toil of black men and women under exploitative empires. As Martinican poet and politician Aimé César wrote beautifully, I tell myself Bordeaux and Nantes and Liverpool and New York and San Francisco. Not one inch of this world doesn't bear my digital imprint, my calcaneum on the back of skyscrapers, and my squalor in the sparkle of gems. As a member of Europe's black community, this Europe I speak of is all part of my heritage too, my inheritance too, sorry. And it was time to wander and celebrate the continent like I owned it, a continent that has frequently, to quote César's protégé Frantz Fanon, woven me out of a thousand details, anecdotes and stories. A Europe that, as I would see, was populated by Egyptian nomads, Sudanese restaurateurs, Swedish Muslims, black French militants, Belgian Congolese painters. A continent of Cape Verdean favelas, Algerian flea markets, Surinamese shamanism, German reggae, Moorish castles. All this was part of Europe too. And these were areas that needed to be understood and embraced if Europe wanted to enjoy fully functional societies. And black Europeans too need to understand Europe and to demand participation in societies, demand the right to document and disseminate our stories. And finally, to those who are used to privilege, equality can seem like oppression. Such people might ask, so where is the European part in this Afropean? In the same way that people ask why such a thing as Black History Month exists in Britain, but not White History Month. This is like asking why London has a Chinatown, but not an England town. England and whiteness are so omnipresent, they can seem invisible. White history isn't projected as white history because it's history. It dominates TV shows and curricula and surrounds us constantly. I wrote in a European language, travelled through European streets and grappled constantly with European history, as in like an invisible force. But I'm not an anthropologist or a historian, I'm a writer and a photographer, and I'm also a black citizen living in Europe now. And this journey was an attempt at making sense of that. So with my brown skin and my British passport, still a free ticket into mainland Europe at the time of writing, one cold October morning I set out in search of the Afropeans. Thank you.
Good. Well, we got a little bit of time between you and me to chat a little bit, and then we'll let everybody else come in as well. I might bring them in as we go as well, because there are some interesting issues that will go beyond us. I want to begin at the heart of the book, or things at the heart of the book, and then some other matters which are perhaps more obliquely present, or perhaps not even present at all. One of the things Johnny said to me, like just a few minutes before we came in the door was, he said, "Oh, there's one thing I didn't put in the book." I was like, "Actually, there's quite a lot you didn't put in the book." Not that they were like missed out and you should have put them in, but literally he tells you he's missing it out. But starting with more, at least with the at the heart of the book and the context, in that context, the leading concept of the Afropean. Now, you define that in a certain way, like informally throughout the book. When you use it, you sort of, the Afropean, and you'll give some kind of gloss of what you want to mean by that.
Yeah.
But actually, my favourite is right at the end, page 380. It's really okay. Towards right at the end. You invoke it in terms of a kind of a mosaic of experiences rather than a monolithic identity. And I think that was an interesting thought for you to finish with, that the Afropean isn't, as it were, this other identity which you can circumscribe and specify. It's mosaic of things. You say, the Afropean reality is a bricolage of blackness and of an Africa that is both in and of Europe.
Yeah.
I thought that was a really, really sort of striking expression. It's actually, I don't know if, it doesn't matter if you knew or didn't know, but there's a sort of counter vision provided by an anthropologist called Talal Assad, writing about Muslims in Europe, where he says exactly the opposite, that as it were, they're present in Europe, but absent from Europe. So as it were, part of what they don't belong to what we mean by Europe, although they're present in it. Nietzsche, in the 19th century, said something similar about the Jews in Europe. He said that the Jews, for him, seem to be in Europe, but not of it. So I was really struck that, you know, you almost got the same words that these other people are using, but affirmed it, both in and of Europe. And so now, you know, you've been living with this concept for a while now, and you've liked it. You've kind of made it your own and gone your own way with it. Now, I'm thinking now that if we want to hold on to that thought of the both in and of Europe, how's that going for you?
How's it going for me? It's interesting. I do. You know, Carol Phillips said that he is of and not of Europe.
Okay.
And I guess it's trying to find that space between being utterly European, being so much a part of, feeling a part of what's going on here. And actually, you know, being brought up, having a fairly happy time, all things considered, you know. And not everybody did, I know, but my own experience was that I was born and raised in, I'm thankful in many ways that I was, you know. But then at the same time, that proximity, it's trying to make sense of the proximity to this idea that has so influenced you, but then that also rejects you as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that one of the things that allows this to take place, this sort of Afropean mosaic, is that being through and through European always admits of not being European through and through, right?
Yeah.
Now, I was thinking in that respect about Britain, because you say Europe, your home, where you learn to read and write in Sheffield, right? And so you have both the British context and around it or inside it, a European one. And I was thinking, so when I was growing up, the big question had been, can you be black British? And, you know, there's Paul Gilroy's book, There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack. And the question was how accommodating a concept could being British be to not being just white, right? Mm-hmm. So being black British. And I had a huge argument with an Italian philosopher who works in Amsterdam called Enzo Rossi, who was saying that he didn't think black British worked at all. The only thing he thought would work would be sort of black European. Mm. Black European, that for him has seemed absolutely seamlessly fine. Black British, he thought, was kind of contradictory. Bizarrely, I had thought the opposite. I thought being black and British is just like totally unproblematic as a concept. And black European was the weird one, because Europeans, they're the white people, as it were. And so I was wondering how...
I struggle with black British, and I don't know, I think it's because, I think part of it is the fact that I'm not from London. So I feel like I've always been on the periphery of that idea. I went on a tour of black British writers, and there were 12 of us. And if you took the black part of the black British, went on tour in America, took the black part of the black British equation, you had Uganda, Kenya, Somalia, St. Kitts, Trinidad, Jamaica, Nigeria, Ghana represented.
Yeah.
I was the only non-Oxbridge-educated non-Londoner. So the British part was completely London-centric. And I've always felt that, like, actually there's a kind of, I use that term sort of in that book, sort of Brixtonisation. There's a kind of reduction of what it is to be black and British.
Interesting. I was brought up in London, in Haringey. You know, I went to a state school in North London.
Oh, yeah.
And the school would have probably had a white majority, but, like, it was not obviously so. And so I think growing up in London when I did, being black and British looked really normal. So do you think being in Sheffield it was different?
It wasn't that being sort of black and British wasn't normal. It was just almost like the branding of the Black Britain Club just didn't seem to fit. And that's why I think, you know, Carol Phillips wrote The European Tribe, his first piece of non-fiction, looked beyond Britain. This island scares me. I feel marooned and trapped sometimes, and I don't like the idea that I am from here. On the one hand, I embrace being from here, but on the other hand, I don't want to think that this is it. And that's why Brexit scares me so much, is because I want to feel connected to something larger.
Yeah, we'll come back to that.
Okay. Oh no, please no. But I feel very much marooned here. It scares me, the idea.
But I mean, you could say there ain't no black in the European flag either. And it's like, why did you feel? What makes you feel, as it were, conceptually for now, or at least like how things strike you about what it means to be European that makes it accommodating to the Afropean portmanteau?
I mean, for one thing, I think it's a bit, it's underexplored territory in a certain way. I think there's a real sort of obsession with the Anglophone, and I have a US and UK passport. I'm a US and UK British citizen. And those two places, for me, do scare me. What really worries me more than Britain is the influence of America. And I wanted to look over across the continent and look at a black community who'd never really had a civil rights movement and were dealing with colonialism rather than slavery. Not to say that there isn't a connection there between European colonialism and slavery, but there's a difference. Yeah. I feel like Europe can have a way of destroying by assimilation. I feel like black Europe doesn't necessarily have icons, and blackness isn't exported as part of the European mythology. And so I wanted to, I guess I initially set out wanting to unearth these stories. You know, it's amazing some of the things that I didn't know before setting out on the journey. You know, like Alexander Pushkin's last novel was about his great, you know, African grandfather, and that sort of that amazing lineage there. So many stories. Like I said, I mentioned in my talk that I felt like I'd been woven out of 1,000 details, anecdotes, and stories.
I'll tell you what, let us see if anybody does have any thoughts about this black British, black European thing, whether anyone feels like one of them works better for them in some way or not.
It's also, I want to say as well that this isn't...
No.
Okay.
Anybody? No? Okay, yes, come on. Yeah, wait just for the mic so that the recording will pick you up.
If we're just talking about personal experience, I would say that I have maybe a weird experience of feeling more black European, having lived in Britain my whole life, but having been raised by my mother, who's German. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't go home to a British house. I don't like a lot of British things. I can't really relate to as much as would be expected, like looking at me, for example.
Right. I mean, there is a fascinating movement in your book from Sheffield to Europe, right? So the book begins in Sheffield and life in what is an unmistakably British place in some ways. And its horizon, if it has one, is not much, doesn't extend much beyond Britain if it extends beyond Sheffield. I mean, maybe musically, perhaps beyond itself. But what in the book, you go from Sheffield, boy in Sheffield, to young man with his backpack going around Europe. And it's a story on one level of one of a million narratives of becoming European, of somebody becoming European. As a matter of fact, that idea of becoming European is, as it were, often thought about what being European is. I mean, that there is no being European. Mm. There is only this sort of becoming European. But what I was really struck by in the book is that we learn almost nothing about that passage for you, for that boy, to becoming European. How on earth was it that Europe appeared on the horizon, or as the new horizon? And so I do want to ask something about, you tell us two things, actually. Mm. You say you went to college.
Yeah.
And because otherwise you just get school.
Yeah.
And I went to college. Okay, well, I went to college.
Yeah, dropped out. Yeah.
And then you say, you didn't say that.
No.
The book is absolutely stuffed with secrets. He does talk about secrets at one point. He said, this is about Stockholm. You say, it's my little secret. But, like, in this book, there seem to be, which is all about uncovering invisibilities, you keep quite a lot of invisible stuff. Anyway, this boy in Sheffield, becoming European, he went to college, but we don't know anything about that, and you went to work for a long time. You said you worked your arse off,
mm-hmm.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
to make it, and then you began packing up, and you said you were, at that point, you're packing up in London. So somehow you'd also got to London, or maybe you just happened to be there that day.
Yeah, there's actually a London chapter in the book, you know, but we took it out. Right. Yeah, so you're probably picking up on that. There's a London chapter.
Whether with the book in view or not, how do you think it happened? Because I've got an idea about this. I'm sure other people might have an idea. And it's not unrelated to some of your stories about nostalgia for lost futures that you began with, but how do you think that that boy in Sheffield became somebody who moved inside the space of something European?
It's sort of too opaque and odd to. It's funny, I grapple with this because a bunch of very strange experiences. Let's talk about me quitting college. Let's begin there.
Okay. Where did you go?
Me quitting. I went to a place called Norton College, also demolished. my school, Heri's School, was in the top, bottom 10 achieving schools in the UK the year that I graduated. And you can actually see some of it, but nobody knows this because we don't document our history or anything. But there's the Ken Loach film called Looks and Smiles, 1982, beautiful, shot by Chris Menges, who ended up winning an Oscar. So my city and kind of a lot of the culture was documented by an Oscar-winning cinematographer. It's an amazing, and nobody knew about this. I was the first person among everybody I knew that had said, this is our school, and that has now been demolished. But anyway.
College.
Yeah, so college, quit college and spent a couple of years dossing around working a part-time job in a B&Q warehouse and noticing this sort of divide in the city. It's really interesting because Sheffield's a great city if you're not from Sheffield or in some ways it's a great university city and some of the amazing cultural events that are on there, the music scene, but you need an NUS card to get in. So there's this sort of divide between the people who had NUS cards even during the evening and people who didn't. So I spent this 2 years wandering aimlessly, trying to make sense of it and watching obscure European cinema. And
what?
I don't know. Like, the thing is, as well, is like, I don't know. Like, maybe it doesn't seem a fit that a black working class kid.
No, it's not that.
No,
it's
I'm not saying that you're saying that. I'm saying that maybe.
How did that come though? Why was it that? What, you know?
There's a place called the Showroom, and I've always had a visual eye, and I've always taken photographs, and I made sense of my time when I was sort of, I mean, unemployed for a lot of it, and then working this dead end job, and I spent a lot of the free time this weird. Some of the book is suffused with an atmosphere that I can't let go of from that time of the midweek afternoon, the quiet midweek afternoon where everybody's going places but you're not. And I can't let that go. And I've got novel ideas. I can't let go of that 2 years where there was this sort of strange period where I was doing nothing, but and yet at the same time it was a fertile.
Wow.
I was walking through the B-side, you know, it was this fertile place. And so it was a chance to encounter things. I'd walk around. There were still a few independent music shops. And I remember encountering this CD by a singer called Stephen Simmons, who has Jamaican and Swedish heritage. And thinking, oh, there are black people in Sweden? Amazing. Watching random films at the Showroom Cinema. And sort of, and Europe, I guess, it didn't really make sense for me to talk about it in the book, or maybe it does, but Europe for me was an escape from the class system of this country, an escape from the lack of future that I had in this country.
Right. One of the things, though, you know, we, again, when we were talking before, you were characterising the time that you grew up in the 80s as having missed out on the really interesting bit, which had just happened, right, punk and stuff like that in the 1970s, that Sheffield and Britain and London and anywhere else, perhaps, and all over the place, was in the 1970s seemed to you, looking back at it from a time that you hadn't even been there, as a much better place to have grown up. Something else was happening in the 80s, which you were seeing as a kind of evacuation of a lot of sense making of how things made sense to us, and you began mentioning. This idea of nostalgia for lost futures, one of which would be the communist thing. So the nostalgia for lost futures is looking back to a time where we still had a future to dream of, right?
Yeah.
And in Britain, that time, of course, is heavily embedded in its own empire experience and so on. And you get what Paul Gilroy talks about, the melancholy for the lost empire and so on, which is a related thought. But what does happen to Britain in the 1980s, which you kind of note, but you also, perhaps not unreasonably, in some respects, want to distance yourself from, was the growth of Britain as a European country, it becoming European. I mean, we'll get to Brexit and so on, but there's one of the things I saw through the 80s, particularly late 80s and into the 90s, was... this country beginning to think that maybe it's a European country. And I was wondering if whether you were sort of on, not on the wave of that, but were on the inside of that movement, so that you're becoming European, as it was taking place perhaps at the same time as something in this country was doing the same.
That's a fascinating observation. I think it's completely true, especially in Sheffield, that was sort of a new Labour stronghold. You'd see the European, everything was funded by the European. We had a European market, and there was a sense, I think Sheffield was trying to reinvent itself after the collapse of industry. And I think Sheffield itself saw a future as a European city in lots of ways. But I think one thing, again, like Mark Fisher talks about it, is one of the things that I think, like my brother and sister are 11 and 12 years older than me, and they're nicer, smarter people than I am, because they're not part of a generation that is obsessed with comfort, and social mobility, in terms of like leaving less 10 bob millionaires when they grew up, you know. And I feel like my culture, it was all about the rise of celebrity culture. And Mark, sorry, to go back to Mark Fisher, he talked about how as there were all these ideas, Derrida and stuff, that you could see in the music journalism, in The Wire or whatever, or The Face. Mm. So there was, I'm doing an interview with Robert Elms tomorrow, I'm really excited about that. It'll be really,
good morning, London.
But you know, the people who were almost like sort of intellectuals within these everyday environments that you could encounter, if even if you didn't go to a university. And I feel like there was a cut-off point there. Mm. And also, I mean, miners striking it, but like a kind of destruction of working class culture.
Yeah.
And honestly, I wish my brother and sister were here. They are better than me. I'm a happier person, and I'm a more gregarious person, more confident, because my life has been about searching for happiness, which I think through this book was trying to untangle that. Because I don't think a good life is a happy life. I think a good life is a deep life. And I think they kind of got brought up, even though it might have been a dark time. I'm being romantic about their life, but I think that their goals and aspirations weren't to be rich and famous and to be on TV. And I think my generations were. Sorry if you're part of my generation. I'm not, you know.
Well, actually, maybe we'll talk about that conception, that vision of a certain part of your generation, including black people in your generation there. One of the things I said is your book is attempting to make visible things that go missing, for example, in a short history of Europe, or even a long one, yeah, for that matter. So there's a lot of trying to recover something inside Europe, already of Europe, that, as it were, doesn't belong to its dominant narratives. And I mean, that's not an untypical gesture. But there was one variation in there that I was really... I mean, I don't know if this is a personal thing, but that I was really struck that you didn't talk about, particularly given what you're talking about the movement from the 70s, the destruction of the working class industries and so on, was the emergence in Europe, in Sheffield, in London, and not just in a Brixtonized sense, of successful young black people. And not only as celebrities, not only as beautiful young people who could appear in magazines, but who were what one better call the emergence of a black middle class. And you talk about, you meet them in the book, and you meet them in absolute passing, that you're in Amsterdam and there's a group coming by and they're both black and white people and they're successful somethings, maybe they're architects, I don't know what they are, you don't know what they are. And you see them as passers-by, but you then pass them by. And I was wondering why you didn't get interested in the black... I mean, it's perhaps a totally banal thing to ask you, but why you didn't get interested in the experience of this new black middle class all over Europe?
I felt that was... I think maybe two things. I think one is that I felt that was a more obvious thing to do. I kind of mentioned at the beginning of the book that would be, let's look, I don't know. It started out as a very optimistic book, wanting to look at the success stories of black Europe, you know, which I think there are success stories of black Europe. But I think I was confronted, I think it was just about who I encountered, and I think I was confronted more often than not with black people who weren't academics and architects and doing terribly well. And you know, in my defence, I do talk to Carol Phillips, in the book. I talk to Mary Dawn of Zap Mama, who's doing really well. Who else is in there? And I kind of try to address that situation in Stockholm as well, because I think that is a black identity that you really are confronted with.
Yeah.
I think you are confronted with a very middle class black culture, and I find it attractive. You know, I want to be a part of it. You know, and I'm sort of not quite, but for me, it just seemed like.
I mean, you leave them out though, right? You leave them out of the book. But I mean,
not always. I don't think that's unfair. I don't think always.
Well, in terms of the characters we meet, they're not like given. You don't tell their story in the same way. No. They're there, but then they're sort of not there. Mm. Anyway, and I was sort of struck by that because I mean, I one side of me would be content at a certain point to see that as part of a hopeful narrative, but. most of your feelings about it are more sceptical. It's like about they're getting involved in something that is perhaps questionably commercialised and caught up in the kind of world that you described a few minutes ago